Interference in American elections, the sponsorship of extremist politics in Europe, war in Ukraine. In recent years, Vladimir Putin's Russia has waged a concerted campaign to expand its influence and undermine Western institutions. But how and why did all of this come about, and who orchestrated it? In the new book, Putin's People, investigative journalist and former Moscow correspondent Catherine Belton reveals the untold story of how Vladimir Putin and the small group of KGB men surrounding him rose to power and looted their country. Catherine Belton worked as the Moscow correspondent for the Financial Times from 2007 to 2013. In 2016, she was the newspaper's legal correspondent. She has previously reported on Russia for Moscow Times and Business Week. Again, the name of the new book is Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took on the West. It's a great pleasure to welcome Catherine Belton to the roundtable this morning. Catherine, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you very much for being with us. Obviously, this has been your beat for a long time. At what point did you start to think that you could put this together into a narrative as to kind of corralling all of these stories and to tell us about Vladimir Putin's rise?
Well, it really did actually take a very long time. I was actually working on it from 2013 onwards. I never intended to work on it for so long, but it became sort of quite an evolutionary process. I mean, I began working on it mostly because I felt that there was still things that we didn't understand about Putin's regime, about where he came from, about how he came to power, and also about this enduring power of the KGB networks after the Soviet fall. It really seemed to me that, you know, that the West had kind of perhaps little understood how the KGB had remained a force sort of behind the scenes, even amid the tumult of the Soviet collapse and Boris Yeltsin's rise in the 90s. And it just seemed to me that it was kind of ripe for investigation. And as I did investigate, yes, there were sort of documents and many interviews that I was able to get, which did indeed suggest that the KGB had quietly remained behind the scenes in the 90s as a force to be reckoned with, and that they had actually operated in some ways to install their man in power to replace Yeltsin, and also that sort of even during the Soviet collapse, they'd been preparing to preserve their networks by funneling out sort of billions of dollars of assets into networks abroad. And it became this sort of story that began almost evolving by itself, because as I was reporting, then it was sort of Putin's great gambit at sort of his revenge, the annexation of Crimea and all these, as I was reporting, sort of I was speaking to sort of ex-KGB allies of his, and they were all they would talk about were these efforts about how the kind of raison d'etre of the moment was for Russia to kind of reassert its position on the world stage. All they wanted was to have a greater say over global affairs, which they believed that they were entitled to. And as they were saying this, sort of one by one, we began to see these efforts to undermine Western democracies, whether it be through funding extremist parties on the left and right in Europe, or this strange network of individuals, these the Russian billionaires and former Soviet tycoons and other shady operators who've been surrounding Donald Trump almost since the early 90s. So it was kind of a story that evolved as I reported it. Certainly when I set out, I didn't intend for it to become as huge as it did become. Initially, it was meant to be a look at sort of the how Putin's economy operated and how his KGB cronies had operated to take over much of the country's economy. But as I investigated, this sort of much stronger undercurrent emerged, in which essentially it was all about sort of Russia's efforts and exactly the efforts of Putin's KGB allies to reassert a role for Russia on the world stage. And because they weren't able to do that through creating a competitive economy, it was by means of resorting to the covert efforts of the KGB playbook by undermining and trying to sow and disrupt other countries and kind of undermine and divide and disrupt them.
In the reporting of this book, you certainly raised a lot of hackles in within Moscow of asking the questions, right? I mean, this was not something that was taken lightly.
No, it wasn't. I mean, again, it was an evolutionary process. At the beginning, I had to be quite careful. I made several trips to St. Petersburg, where sort of Putin had cut his teeth as the city's deputy mayor, and essentially joined in an alliance for the ex-KGB officials and organized crime to run the city and take over the city's main cash flows, whether it be through kind of controlling the city's seaport, which also became a major hub for the trafficking of drugs from Latin America into Europe, and in which the KGB and the organized crime allies had a serious stake in that, and sort of through other nefarious means, taking control of kind of the city's fuel sector. So I had to be very careful when kind of trying to report this. And unfortunately for that area, many of the sources do remain anonymous, but I did have considerable help from some ex-KGB people who'd work with Putin on some of these deals, and also some former organized crime people and some former officers from the security services themselves, which had investigated some of the goings on then. So had to be quite careful. But it was also the case that I actually did leave Russia in mid-2004, shortly after the downing of the MH17 aircraft by pro-Russian rebels in Ukraine. It was already, the climate was very much turning sour against the West. Obviously, Putin's annexation of Crimea and then ensuing sanctions were changing things pretty rapidly. And many of my sources were starting to get nervous about speaking to me in Moscow and elsewhere in Russia. So I actually went back to London thinking that I'd be able to finish my book quite quickly. But when I got back to London, I found that there were more sources in London, and indeed my old sources in Moscow were actually coming through London quite frequently and were much more comfortable at talking to me there, that was away from sort of being observed in Moscow. So it actually became a richer story actually for moving away. So yes.
I mean, obviously the title really says it all of Putin's people, because Putin is center. But he does come off rather as a shadowy figure in this book, and you write about this group, his circle of people, and ultimately the creation of what you refer to as KGB capitalism. So talk a little bit about what that is and the great power that it has, not just in Russia, but throughout the world.
Yeah, I mean, it was really a kind of a gradual process in which sort of the network of KGB officers who came to power together with Putin began sort of piece by piece taking back control of the country's strategic cash flows. And in terms of strategic cash flows, I mean the country's oil sector and the commodities giant, all these real raw materials that Russia's economy is so rich in. I mean, it first really began as a defensive play, because there was one oligarch in particular, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who in 2003 was Russia's richest man and owned the country's biggest oil giant. And he very much seemed like a threat to Putin's security men. They believed that Khodorkovsky might even envision a run for the presidency himself in 2008. He was seeking to ally himself with the West, making regular trips to the U.S. He wanted to build pipelines that were out of control of the Russian state, and he also wanted to sell control of his oil giant to a U.S. company, which would have given him billions of dollars to play with and spend on the political field. So they basically decided to take him out. But once they did, through a series of trumped-up retroactive tax charges, and they'd thrown him in jail in the process, it began sort of an almost unstoppable process. One of his former associates told me that that basically sort of appetite comes during eating. And as they were able, piece by piece, to sort of take over bits of the Russian economy, subverting the country's legal system, as they went, they began to be able to take over the rest of the country's kind of main strategic enterprises. And at first, it was a kind of a process in which Putin put his closest former KGB allies in charge of various sectors of the economy. But once they jailed Khodorkovsky and they've been able to also so clearly subvert the country's legal system by threatening judges and sort of intimidating them and sort of, you know, essentially, you know, they were able to take over the court system through a very clear process of intimidation and casting of innuendo and basically making sure that anyone who wanted to get anywhere had to follow their orders. Once they'd done that, it became clear to sort of other titans of Russian business who'd made their fortunes during the Yeltsin years that they also had to bow to the Kremlin's will. And it very much became a process that by 2008, as one of these tycoons told me, that if you get a call from the Kremlin saying that you have to spend $1 billion or $2 billion on this or that project, you can't refuse. You have to follow the orders because essentially you're not really the owner of your own business. You get to keep it as long as you stay in the Kremlin's good books, and that means carrying out strategic tasks for them. So it was a way in which that essentially Putin's ex-security service officials had been able to resurrect a system that the KGB had almost set in place on the eve of the Soviet collapse, when they created networks of trusted custodians, loyal allies who are managing funds and funneling funds for the KGB into the West. So you had now in Putin's Russia, you have this network of Putin's closest allies, many of them KGB connected, and also this network of independent, well, once independent business tycoons who hold and control sort of vast amounts of funds in the West, but who are also ready to spend it on any influence operations that the Kremlin might require. It's sort of the kind of the nod of a hat. So, you know, it's they've kind of resurrected a system of in which a KGB sort of a former officer has been able to sort of create a network of loyal allies and trusted custodians who can funnel huge amounts of money through the Western system. And indeed, obviously compared to sort of KGB operations of the 80s, you know, Putin's men now have tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars more cash at their command. And indeed, since Russia's transition to the market economy, Russia is so deeply integrated into the Western economy that the UK's own Intelligence and Security Committee produced a report that came out a few weeks ago, which said that many of these networks have now become so deeply entrenched within Western market institutions.
Talk a little bit about those networks.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, I mean, the networks, unfortunately, are very difficult to unravel. I mean, the UK Intelligence and Security Committee, which is basically a parliamentary oversight group which has powers of oversight over the intelligence agencies in the UK, they produced a report a few weeks ago which pointed out this very close fusion now between Russian businessmen and the state, and indeed this close fusion between Russian businessmen and how they act very closely with the Russian intelligence services. So it's kind of is this kind of process in which it's very difficult to draw the line between sort of independent business and sort of who is acting on behalf of the Russian intelligence services, which means the networks are kind of sort of ever present, because, you know, you have a lot of Russian businessmen who have big holdings in London or perhaps in the US Many of them have had Western listings for their companies. You now have sort of Russian tycoons, for example, in the US, who have sort of acquired aluminium smelters or other big businesses and are able to continue to do so unhindered, regardless of the kind of the quite changing environment in the US since the 2016 election. I mean, some Russian oligarchs were sanctioned over Russia's interference, but others who are equally close to Vladimir Putin, such as Roman Abramovich, have been sort of even recently acquiring sort of big facilities in the US. And so it's quite an easy job for Russian tycoons to purchase political influence, whether it be in the UK or the US. And one former associate of a Russian oligarch told me, he said, look, all you need to do is spend like £3 or 4 million buying a kindergarten in a local town in the US. And all of a sudden, you know, you've bought yourself quite a lot of influence. And obviously for a Russian oligarch, when you're sort of commanding fortunes of $10 billion or more, then $3 or 4 million to spend is not very much money at all. And it's the same in the UK. It's even more petty here, because I think sort of, you know, the levels of funding in the UK political system are so much less, especially compared to the US. And then, so that's the kind of the clear sort of type of money that's sort of being kind of the donations by individual kind of Russian tycoons, whether they have sort of business interests in the US or in the UK. But then there's also the issue of dark money and where this is coming from and how it goes into both the UK and the US political systems. I mean, in the US, I think there's been very recent efforts to crack down on some of the dark money, because obviously a lot of money goes into the US political system through super PACs. And then these can be funded in turn through LLCs, these Delaware corporations, where beneficial ownership is not disclosed. So you can have huge amounts of money of unknown origin going into the U.S. political system. But I think there have been recent moves through Congress and the Senate to kind of enforce a greater disclosure of the LLCs in Delaware. So hopefully there will be sort of steps taken to begin to eradicate some of these flows. But, you know, we have to really look at some of the kind of the major money laundering scandals that have emerged out of Russia as well, sort of since Putin came to power. There are a couple of well-known ones. There's one known as the Moldovan laundromat, in which $14 billion of illicit cash was funneled out of Russia into the West. And then there was the better known Deutsche Bank mirror trade scandal, in which another $10 billion was in illicit cash flows was laundered out of Russia and into Western bank accounts through Deutsche Bank. There's a kind of very interesting parallels between both schemes, because both schemes were overseen by the same set of bankers and also by the same set of very senior officials in the Russian security services, who are not only taking a cut of the proceeds through turning a blind eye to some of the cash flows, but I'm told by some of the bankers who participated in the schemes that they're using these schemes as well to kind of funnel their own kind of strategic influence money into the West, that they can sort of use the cover of the billions of dollars in cash going out. So I think they recently Senate counterintelligence report really did highlight some of those very troubling links, in particular those of Paul Manafort, his former campaign chairman, with Oleg Deripaska, which the report very clearly states was working in cooperation with the Russian state and intelligence services on a whole host of operations, influence and otherwise in many countries. So I think, yes, there's still many many questions about the ties between Trump and Russia, but I certainly tried to dig into them too in my book. And the final chapter, of course, is devoted to this. And I did find some very interesting ties going back to the 1990 when Trump was first approached by a former Soviet businessman who'd been very close to the leading lights of the Soviet foreign intelligence services. Indeed, he'd been sent out as an emigre. He was an antique smuggler. And this was a person who'd been approached himself by, or at least according to his story, by some Atlantic City casino operators who'd heard the myths then of the huge amounts of communist party money that was being funneled into the West and thought the Atlantic City casinos might be a good home for them. This operator was, this former Soviet operator was Shalva Chigirinsky, and he, soon after he was approached by the Atlantic City guys, he was introduced to Donald Trump, where they kind of formed the beginnings of a very beautiful friendship. And it was also the start of a kind of a network of Moscow money men who were in one way or another connected to Mr. Chigirinsky, who began to orbit Trump almost ever since, and either working with him on real estate deals or kind of essentially helping bail him out from bankruptcies, because we all know how loaded Trump was all the time in debt. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting things to find.
There's many ways probably of asking this final question, but how much do you think that the release of the President of the United States' tax returns would help you in perhaps a revised edition of your book?
I think it would be crucial. I mean, obviously, you know, there are lots of interesting links already that have been found. But one of the key questions, for instance, was to what degree did the people behind Bayrock, the New York real estate firm led by the likes of Felix Sater, who was also coincidentally or not a friend of Felix Sater, to what degree did Bayrock, which worked with Trump on a number of real estate projects in the U.S.
Well, Catherine Belton's new book is Putin's People, How the KGB Took Back Russia and Then Took on the West. The book is published by FSG. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.